I want to introduce myself. My name is Veronica Gordon. I am a 3L at Vanderbilt University Law School, and I am the executive editor of LPAR. This panel will be focusing on the article Enhancing Public Access to Online Rulemaking Information, which addresses public participation and transparency in federal rulemaking, similar to the last panel. This piece was initially published in the Michigan Journal of Environmental and Administrative Law. Our author is Carrie Cognisi, and he is the Edward B. Shills Professor of Law and Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. He specializes in the study of regulation and the regulatory process, with a particular emphasis on the empirical evaluation of alternative regulatory strategies and the role of conflict and cooperation in business-government relations. He currently directs the Penn Program on Regulation and has served on the ABA's Task Force on Improving Regulations.gov, chair of Task Force on Transparency and Public Participation that offered a blueprint to the Obama administration on open government, and founded regblog.org, the leading online source for regulatory news, analysis, and opinion. Professor Cognisi received his undergraduate degree at the University of Idaho, then went on to obtain his master's in public policy, his JD, and his PhD at the University of Michigan. To help us better understand and assess Professor Cognisi's proposals, we are honored to have a wonderful, experienced, and thoughtful panelists. Our first commenter is Andrea Fields, who is the managing partner of the Washington, D.C. office of Hunt & Williams. Ms. Fields' practice centers on environmental and administrative law, with a particular emphasis on federal rulemaking and litigation arising from the Clean Air Act. Ms. Fields has been listed in the Best Lawyers in America for Environmental Law since 1989, among other accolades, and was the first woman elected to chair the American Bar Association's Environment, Energy, and Resources section. Ms. Fields received her undergraduate degree from Yale University and her JD from the University of Virginia. Our second commenter is Catherine McFate, the President and CEO of the Center for Effective Government. Before taking her current position in 2011, she served as program officer at the Ford Foundation, where she led a grant-making program on transparent, effective, and accountable government. Throughout her career, she has been involved in various communication initiatives to understand public attitudes towards government. She received her graduate degrees from Yale University. And our third and final panelist is Manisha Patel, who serves as the Deputy General Counsel for the Council of Environmental Quality within the Executive Office of the President. There, Ms. Patel works closely with federal agencies, state and local governments, stakeholders, and other White House offices to develop policies and initiatives that advance the President's environmental, national resources, and energy agenda. Prior to serving in her current capacity, Ms. Patel served as the Deputy Associate Director for Regulatory Policy at the Council on Environmental Quality. Ms. Patel is a graduate of Northwestern University and the Georgetown University Law Center. And we look forward to hearing your thoughts. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Veronica. Carrie, start us off.
Thank you very much for that introduction, Veronica. Thank you to ELI, Linda, and to Vanderbilt, JB, and others for the honor of being here today. I appreciate as well in advance the comments by Andrea and Catherine and Manisha. Manisha, thank you for your public service as well. I'm pleased to be here today, and I wanted to just segue from the last panel to this panel by drawing a conceptual comparison between democracy and open government, and I think we could spend all afternoon, the rest of the afternoon at least, talking about the differences and similarities between the two concepts. But here at the outset, I just want to call attention to something that's very similar about both concepts. That is, everybody really supports them, right? Who is going to oppose democracy and who really, in principle, opposes open government? But just as political scientists and even lawyers have told us about democracy, that as much as a broad principle it receives wide affirmation, what democracy actually means depends on the details. The details about voting laws, the details about campaign finance rules. Those are the things that really tell us whether a democracy is robust or not. And there's a similarity with open government, and this is really related to my paper and the point I want to make in my opening remarks here. It's that open government, yes, it's also something that seemingly gets widespread, and if not universal, support. But the design features, the architecture of open government, will really make a difference as to whether openness is real and robust, or whether it's something that's simply nodded to and affirmed in the abstract. In particular, when it comes to thinking about access to government information about rulemaking and to means of participating in the rulemaking process, as we've been talking about, open government is more than just about access. It's also about the ease of access. And I'm going to focus in particular in my remarks here about some design features of government websites. And I'm going to argue that rulemaking is a top substantive task for government. It's truly a top task. And it deserves attention to how easy it is for citizens to access information about the rulemaking process. That ease of access is important, even if rulemaking is not a top task in the sense of widespread user demand. And a lot of website design tendencies today is to design websites all around user demand and look at top tasks in terms of what users want to find. Rulemaking may not actually rank very well for many of the reasons we've just talked about on that score, but substantively, we're talking about a function of government that involves making the rules that we all have to comply with, rules that are backed up by the force of law and all the penalties, that criminal and civil, that come along with these rules. So rulemaking is a truly top task. Now, I will start by giving a little bit of history of my own. It follows much of what Cynthia had articulated about the difference between rulemaking and rulemaking 1.0 or e-rulemaking 1.0 and e-rulemaking 2.0. Back in March of 2002, I first started to think about issues of information technology and the regulatory process. I convened a workshop at that time when I was at the Kennedy School, and I convened another workshop on the subject in January 2003, and then in 2004, now 10 years ago, issued this report, E-Rulemaking, Information Technology and Regulatory Policy. And in that report, we synthesized comments that came out of our two meetings on the subject, and I'm delighted that Cynthia was able to be at those meetings, and others in the room too. Back in those early days, there was a lot of optimism about what information technology could do for public participation. It would revolutionize, some people said, the rulemaking process. It would transform it and make rulemaking from this sleepy backwater aspect of our governmental process into something that was vibrant and vital and fully participatory. And there was a lot of creative ideas that were generated and are contained in that report. Some of those ideas we've seen actually blossom in the intervening years, and regulations.gov has been fully implemented and revised and updated and made quite functional. Cynthia just articulated, the Regulation Room project that she and others at Cornell have developed is following in that visionary spirit that we first articulated there. It is truly smart participation, or Web 2.0, and so it's somewhat reluctantly, I have to say, what I'm going to talk about here, I guess, is not smart participation or Web 2.0 or e-rulemaking 2.0. It's going to be Web 1.0, just the agency website. And, you know, of course, these websites proliferate. Every agency has one, and they're increasing in sophistication as well. But they're not quite as glamorous, perhaps, as some of these other initiatives are. And I don't want to denigrate there at all the regulations.gov or Regulation Room. Those are really important innovations. But I want to step back and look at Web 1.0 for a couple of reasons. The most important one is that websites have become the virtual and in some sense the real front door and face of government in America today. And how they are designed and how citizens interact with them really matters. Now, just a few years ago, when I was developing this article, I felt like I had to make that point in greater detail. Today, since the healthcare.gov website fiasco has come along, all I have to do is show this meme here about the website, and people get the idea that design actually matters. Okay. Ease of access is what I'm talking about. Now, this article grew out of a study that I did for the administrative conference that was conducted in 2011. It addressed agency websites, but also looked at some social media functions that agencies are using, too. I'll focus today just on websites. But a couple of things that came out of this study. One is that we conducted a survey of all agency websites, and we looked at how easy it was to find information about rulemaking on the websites. I was able to replicate an earlier study that I did with Stuart Shapiro at Rutgers University in 2005, and I thought from 2005 to 2011, we've moved in this era, right? All these advances in technology, going mobile, Web 2.0, interactivity, that, things should be better in terms of finding regulatory information on agency websites. But in fact, very, very little progress had been made in that intervening time. We looked at those agencies that issued rulemaking on a regular basis, and we found that in only about two-thirds of those agencies could you find any word related at all, just a word related to rulemaking, regulation, standards, and so forth on the agency's homepage. You couldn't find dockets or lists of rules that were open for comments. About 50%, only 50% of the cases did the agency even provide a link on their homepage over to the regulation.gov website. And yet, see, regulation.gov is a great tool. But if you are an ordinary citizen and you're interested and you hear in the news about something that EPA is doing or something that the Federal Trade Commission is doing, you might read about in the media, where are you going to go to look for that information? First thing, my guess is you're going to go to the EPA's website and the Federal Trade Commission's website. And agencies aren't doing very well in inviting people in at that first step and directing them to relevant regulatory information. And there's a great deal of variation across agencies, and we provide a scorecard, and we show that there's quite varied differences. Just to give you an example of one agency that's done something quite distinctive and above and beyond what other agencies have done, EPA has created its own separate regulatory tracking system and created a website called RegDart that tracks priority rulemakings at the agency and gives members of the public an idea of where these rules are going through the process. Now, that's a great tool. I'd even be happy if agencies just did something even more simple. And let me give you an example here of, it may be hard for most people to see, but the basic point will be apparent to you. This is the FCC's new website, which is actually one of the better, more recent revisions of a website, so it has more of a state of the art. But if you're going to go find rulemaking information on this web page, you have to click on the top in a menu item that's labeled Business and Licensing. Now, I don't know about you, but I sort of think of rulemaking as serving more than just business interests, but actually also advancing the public interest. And I don't know if ordinary citizens would think, if I want to find out what the FCC is doing with a new rulemaking, to look under the tab for businesses. And yet this is probably influenced by that mindset of designing websites along user demand. Who wants to go find information about rulemaking more? Cynthia already said this earlier. Businesses, okay? So that makes some sense, certainly. But again, I'm urging a different mindset about rulemaking, thinking about it as a substantively top task that deserves greater placement. Now, this is not something that I'm calling for that really demands a whole lot of innovation. This is really simple stuff, so much so that you can find what I'm calling for on a whole host of websites by the government, officials who serve in this branch of government that we're in a hall today. So members of Congress have websites, and on those websites they have prominent links on their homepage to legislation. Here's an example from Henry Waxman's website that has a statement on this page for legislation that says, one of the most important aspects of Congress is developing, making, and monitoring laws. New laws are created every week. As a member of Congress, I am trying to be actively involved in sponsoring and drafting legislation about issues that are important to you. Please contact my offices to share your thoughts on current legislation that may affect you, your family, and your community. And there are two links on this page. One to links to legislation sponsored by Henry Waxman. Another to links to legislation that he's co-sponsoring. Now, does a typical member of Congress have a lot of staff that could create lists of all of these sponsored legislation and keep them up to date? That is a very real task that demands very real resources of time in the agency. No, they don't. But what those links do is they take you to the thomas.gov website where all legislation is indexed. And it runs a canned search over to that other database and pops up for you in a seamless exercise all of the bills that are sponsored by Waxman. And lest you think that this is just some Democratic innovation, Michelle Bachmann has virtually the same thing on her webpage too, with the same language that I just quoted, and again, two links, one to sponsored and one to co-sponsored legislation. This can be done today for regulation. This can be done today. Instead of going out to thomas.gov with a canned search and pulling up the sponsored legislation, it's possible to run out canned searches to regulation.gov and pull up all the rules that are currently open for public comment by any regulatory agency. And in fact, at the Penn Program on Regulation, we've created an pilot project, a proof of concept website called rulefinder.org that has a list of major regulatory agencies' names. And when you go to rulefinder.org and you click on the link for an agency's name, you are automatically taken over to a list on regulations.gov of all of those rules that are currently open for public comment by those agencies. Here's the Federal Aviation Administration. And you can, from there, access all the submitted comments, all the agency studies, and if you'd like, you can file a public comment. In the end, it's something like this that I think will get us to real open government, not just access that's theoretical, but access that's real, access that's easier. And I was pleased that the Administrative Conference adopted one of the recommendations in my report, that agencies should indeed put in place, easily accessible from their homepage, a link just like what we've shown with rulefinder.org. And I hope that we will see, going forward, more than just rhetoric about open government and rulemaking, but real progress. Thank you very much.
I'm going to say, usually when I get a call from John Cruden and asking me to participate in a program, it's because he wants me to be a counterpoint to certain people. But I tend to agree with despite my client base, I agree with everything Carrie has said. I come from a perspective of having worked with environmental regulations for almost 40 years. That chart up there will tell you I was trying to get some kind of measure of how many regulations EPA has adopted in the last 40 years, and I couldn't come up with an easy way of saying how many rules are out there. But I could look at how many pages in the Code of Federal Regulations are cluttered with EPA rules. And you start out back in 1972, which was 2 years after the creation of EPA, and Clean Air Act had been enacted in 1970, and Water Act was amended in 72. And you have about 4,000 pages of rules in the CFR, 40 CFR. And as you go over time, you see it just keeps growing and growing and growing. And that is occurring even though these major statutes have not recently been amended. So Katie, bar the door if they are amended anytime in the near future. But what that means is that over the last 40 years, there have been hundreds of EPA regulations, and I've been involved in the rulemakings on many of them. I'm kind of a betwixt and between. Because I am over the age of 55, I certainly am not as nimble at using some of the tools that are available today. I have a heavy hand when it comes to trying to find things, you know, pushing things and banging the computer when it doesn't do what I want to do. On the other hand, I still am active in trying to find it. And what I've seen over time is, back in the 1970s when I was first doing this, and you were writing briefs and doing comments, you're sitting in an office. You have to run down to the agency to get copies of the comments. If you're writing a brief, you're writing comments, you're sitting in there, you are typing on a manual typewriter. If you're writing a brief, you may have to file it the next day. You can't do it from the comfort of your home on a computer that you can just send in a draft to someone else. You're sitting in the same office. You may be there, as I recall, at 3 a.m. in the morning, and in a moment of coffee or caffeine-induced euphoria or energy, you want to talk with somebody else, and you start trying to figure out how to get in touch. Well, there's no email. If they're in their offices, you have to go through a switchboard. The switchboard isn't open at 3 a.m., and so you are kind of cut off from the other people that you might be working with. So even a fogey like me thinks technology is really good, because now you can get in touch with anybody, anytime, anywhere on these kinds of issues. I am very respectful of my associates' times. The point of me is I do think there have been vast improvements, but there is still a lot of room for improvement. And rather than talk about some more of the history, I just would like to talk about a few things that I do think right now the agencies could do to improve things. I'm picking several of them because of comments and issues that have been raised earlier today. One was, and I'll probably use an inflammatory term here, regulatory spam, comment spam. And this is when the postcards come in, and there are millions of them. And I agree with Avi. If 3 million people are sending in postcards, and by the way, this is not just environmental groups. It can be campaigns on the other side of these issues as well, whether it's at EPA or the NLRB. You get hundreds of thousands or millions of comments. And I do think it is important for an agency to be able to look at how many people are sending in comments. Even if the people sending in comments have no idea what this is, except that an organization that they trust and they believe in is telling them, this is important, you need to weigh in. That's fine. I leave it to Avi and his people at EPA to figure out how to weigh that. I'm on the pragmatic side, and when I'm going through regulations.gov, I want to be able to get to substantive comments. And when I pull up a screen after pushing the buttons many, many times to get to the right rule, and I got 25 entries on one screen, and it's all these postcards, and I'm screen after screen after screen, and I'm just trying to find something that may be substantive that I need to read and either support or respond to. It would be nice if there was a separate subcategory these comments could be put into, and the EPA could weigh them, or any agency could weigh them, as much or as little as they felt appropriate. But as a commenter, whether from the right, the left, or anywhere in between, I'm able more easily, more nimbly, to get to the comments that are substantive and are not cookie-cutter comments. The other thing I think is going on, Carrie mentioned that websites are sometimes considered the front door of agencies. and got to some website. When you go to websites, I had to go back to an image from the 40s, before my time, but I do listen to Golden Age of Radio comedies on weekends, and there's one that's Fibber McGee and Molly, and every so often in there, at least once per episode, somebody will say, get something out of the closet, and they'll be saying, no, don't open the closet, and closet's opened up, and you hear this horrible clutter of years' worth of stuff falling out of the closet. There are some regulatory agencies where you go to the front page, their front door, and it's like Fibber McGee and Molly's closet. You can't find anything. It is clutter. It is impossible. And Carrie gives a good example of the FCC site where you want to find just where do I find where the rules are discussed, and you can't find it because there's nothing in there that shows you clearly what the doorway is to the thing that you're looking for. One of the frustrations we have also is every time there's a new administration, sometimes more often, but I can guarantee it, when a new administration comes in, one of the first things they do is redesign the website. So those of us, old fogies, who bookmark valuable places on the website, here's where I can go to find everything that has to do with this issue or that issue, and it's not labeled anywhere else, but boy, I've now found it. And it's a gold mine of information. You can click on, and the next Monday after the change of that somebody comes in and changes the website, and that bookmark is worthless. And whatever was there before, it's not duplicated somewhere else. It's not a matter of just finding the new link. It's gone, what you've been relying on. And so, you know, even if an incoming administration is one that you've worked hard to elect and you're really excited, there's still a part of me that says, oh, no, they're going to change their website and I'm not going to be able to find a thing. The other thing is improving search engines. I was just talking with a woman at EPA, and I said, what's very difficult is if EPA is going to do something, let's say it's not a rulemaking, and I'm going to get to that in a minute, my final point. And they're going to do something having to do with Topic X. And I just want to understand a little bit more about Topic X before I call someone at the agency to get more information, before I start drafting comments, certainly. And so I type into the search engine, Topic X. And hey, I've just read a press release where they're going to do something about this, and I'm expecting to be able to find it, and it doesn't pull up anything, or it pulls up some speech given by somebody 7 years earlier. And I'm thinking, okay, so where do I find this? And I said, what I've learned to do is to Google Topic X. And going to Google, Google will send me back to some place on the EPA website that has a cornucopia of information on Topic X, but somehow I can't locate through the search engine. And I was just talking with someone from EPA, and she said, yeah, that's what we do at EPA. We Google these things, and that's how we find things. And there's just got to be a better way to do that, to be able to find things, particularly information on active proceedings. And now let's talk about proceedings versus rulemakings. The rulemaking process, as it's been described here, and as you may know if you've been involved in any of it, can be messy. If I worked for EPA and I had a choice between conducting a rulemaking where under the Clean Air Act, I have to develop a docket, I have to put everything in there, I have to respond to every comment submitted, I've got to have hearings on it. It's a time-consuming, messy process, and I've got to explain why I am agreeing with or not agreeing with every comment that's submitted, and I've got a lot of comments out there. That's on one side. And the other side is I issue guidance. Yeah? If I'm issuing guidance, I don't have to do a proposal. I don't have to solicit comments. If I tell people they can comment, I don't have to evaluate each of those comments. Or when I post a draft guidance document, I don't have to say which comments I thought were really nifty and which ones were not so nifty. And over time, I see EPA moving more towards proceeding by guidance documents, memoranda, than by rulemaking. And that is a way of excluding the public from participating in a process. And I do not believe that that is a good way of proceeding. The other thing it is if you're not doing a rulemaking, it's not in regulations.gov, and it is really tough to find anything about that because there's not one place where you can go to find everything that's related to that. There may be two, three. In one instance, we came up with four different links at EPA, different offices within EPA that were keeping information on one proceeding. And you'd have to go to all of them, and sometimes you couldn't be sure you were getting all the information you needed by going to all of those different websites because there was no central repository and nothing to prevent an individual office within EPA of saying, well, let's come up with our own little place to post everything we're concerned about. So I guess I'll conclude with technology is good. Technology allows me to work at home rather than be in the office at 3 a.m. Technology allows me to call co-counsel or associates at 3 a.m. in the morning, which I wouldn't do because I use restraint. technology allows me to find lots of things, but technology is not the answer to everything, and common sense goes a long way to help on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrea. Okay. I run an organization called Center for Effective Government. Our mission is to build an open, accountable government that invests in the common good, protects people and the environment, and reflects the priorities of the American people. We do research and policy analysis and advocacy work. And I also co-chair the Coalition for Sensible Safeguards, which Union of Concerned Scientists is on our steering committee. We advocate, we're about 150 consumer, small business, labor, science groups, advocacy groups that are committed to protecting and improving our regulatory system. So in both those capacities, we help generate some of those comments and letters that go to the regulatory agency. I am kind of surprised that during the course of the time of this afternoon that there hasn't been more conversation about the context in which all of this is occurring, because we're talking about trying to improve the technology and do things that are going to be labor intensive, time intensive, resource intensive when we're cutting back on staff and the budgets of all these federal agencies. That's important to understand. And since 2011, there have been tremendous attacks on an ongoing basis on the regulatory process and on particular rules and regulations. We have, with the Coalition for Sensible Safeguards, been responding to things that are being introduced in the House like every 2 weeks, some of which are specific attacks on an environmental regulation, but oftentimes they're trying to make the regulatory process itself more cumbersome, slower, delay the rules. So I want to put that as a context before we talk about the role of technology. Because this area and this paper falls into two of the three areas that my organization works on. One is open government and one is regulatory policy. And of course, we share with Carrie this goal of having as open a government as you can, trying to make federal agencies and their websites user-friendly, so that people can get in and find the information that they need. And before I go into a critique of that, I will say that I do think that there's a kind of an unfair comparison, because most people, when they go to a government website, they have Amazon or some kind of private sector website where all they have to do is go on and click through, point and click, and then put in their MasterCard information, and they get something out at the end. And we know that the private companies have all this big data, so they can kind of do their metaphysics in the background and present all the things to you that you know that they think that you want to know anyway. Whereas it's kind of the opposite with a government website, because you have all these unique individuals coming trying to get very complex information out of federal agencies. Think about that, the Obamacare website. You know, you're trying to go through a whole set of complex rules that the federal government has about getting access to some kind of service for you, and they probably have absolutely no information on you except what you're going to submit to them in that moment. So that you have to go through a whole set of things that you're giving them that information. They won't have it in their reserves because you've already ordered something on Amazon. So I do think that people do get very crazy about government websites because they have this comparison in the back of their head that they think it should be instantaneous and work like a transactional website in the private sector. That said, 2 weeks ago we released a report on how on freedom of information, how well freedom of information requests were being processed by the 15 federal agencies that actually put through 90% of all the freedom of information requests. We failed half the 15 agencies. A quarter of the grade was based on the website and whether you could go onto the website, completely do your freedom of information request on the website, get a number, get track so you could come back and find out whether things were moving through. We think that's really important. It's kind of a service issue for citizens. Another piece of it that I think is something that we want to see more of on the regulatory side too is whether or not they have electronic reading rooms. And most federal agencies do not have, the big issue now is they have so much information that it's how do you sort it, how do you file it, how do you make it intuitively available to people when they go and are searching around to see if they can find out what that agency has. It's really hard. Most people do not do a very good job with that, but it's so important. Because if you think about it, especially things like freedom of information requests, that takes labor time and attention. Same with looking up regulations. If you can do it in some way so that it doesn't involve any human beings, so that people can do it themselves, it saves you enormous time and energy. But it's really hard for agencies to do that because of this problem of people coming with a lot of unique characteristics that they have to go through to know what it is that they want from the government website. I also want to say, it's not, I think most people who go on and want to know something about regs are going to be either experts who know something or they're going to be regular citizens who have been mobilized by groups like ours to make some kind of comment. I think there's another piece of not just making comments, but if you're actually there trying to find out something about that rule or regulation that's under consideration, maybe the most important thing you might want to know is something about costs and benefits, which everyone has to do, and it's an increasingly important piece of what happens to those rules. And I just want to tell you a story. I'll see if I can do this quickly, because we, in 2012, we had an intern go through and try to find the cost-benefit analysis. We're particularly concerned with benefits. We know you can get the cost because the industry interest will always give you the cost to industry, which, by the way, are typically very overestimated. When you go back and do retrospectives of whether it really did cost industry that much, it's usually about a quarter to a third of what they estimated up front the cost of a rule would be. So recognizing that, but it's really hard to find the public interest, public benefits to most rules. So here's what we did. We sent these people in and said, can you track? And it was like a complex game of where's Waldo? So here's where we start. Let me just read you some. So agency websites have information that's kind of a maze of links in various department pages. All the websites look different, as you were mentioning, so the ease or difficulty of assessing the cost and benefit information varies dramatically by every agency. Beyond the individual agency website, there's a short list of other sites where you might go to. So you might go to the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, which is your centralized portal that has to review all the rules. It has the authority to determine whether the cost of federal rules are justified for their benefits, so you might think that that's where you would find it. If you go to reginfo.gov, that's OIRA's main website for the regulatory review information. Now, like we've mentioned several times, the site is visually appealing, but you can't find information on a rule without knowing the proper name of the rule, the formal name, and everyone knows those are very convoluted and not intuitive, or its regulatory identification number. Now, if you're just going to, because I want to understand this labor standard that's being discussed, you're probably not going to know the formal name of, you know, the protection of so-and-so and such-and-such, and you're certainly not going to know the regulatory identification number. let's say you've somehow managed to get through that. You find the rules page. Reginfo.gov on OIRA provides a description of the rule and a link to the government printing office's text file, which is not a PDF, of the rule's Federal Register entry. Provides no information on the benefits of the rule in the central place that reviews cost-benefit analysis. So we said, well, let's go to regulations.gov. This electronic docket, you've talked a lot about that. So regulations.gov has a docket page for every rule that is supposed to house all the documents used to support the rule. So you would think the cost-benefit, the benefits would be on that. But to access a rules docket page, you need the rules docket number, which is different than the RIN number. Okay? And to obtain the docket number, you have to either get it from the agency or go to the Federal Register notices. Now, with that information, you can access the rules docket page and try a keyword search to try to find a cost-benefit analysis, but there's no standard designation or label for what a cost-benefit analysis is called. So in some places, it's called an economic analysis. And in some cases, it's called a regulatory impact analysis. And in some places, it's called a cost-benefit analysis. So I think I'm kind of making the case how difficult it is and how convoluted it is to go back and forth. There is no place on, to reinforce the complaints that Carrie has, there is no place on the agency that's responsible for promulgating the rules website where you can get all the information about what's going on with that rule. We think that's really problematic and probably discourages citizen engagement. So, like all of you, we want websites to be more user-friendly and more useful to people, but I do want to take issue with the premise that that people will go out and do it on their own. I think it's always going to be that regular citizens are not going to do mass mailings unless they're mediated by organizations like ours or other people who are pushing them into it. And we think that there are bigger problems with the rule, with the way rules are occurring now. And that one of the most important, and you guys know this too, problems that it persists regardless of who's in the White House, it doesn't matter if it's Democrats or Republicans, is the way the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs politicizes the process of what goes through. And that we're seeing increasingly rules are delayed, weakened, rejected, often to the detriment of consumer or public interest concerns, and to the benefit of the interests of the regulated industries. And if you haven't seen it, I would highly recommend Lisa Heiserling's article, which is just an insider's view of how that happened. We thought that was just incredibly important. I think I'm running out of time, so I won't go into the details on what we just recently did some testimony on this, but I would say I just want to stick in a couple of things around that. You know, the executive order that's around OIRA says that a proposed rule is supposed to be go through within 90 days. In extraordinary circumstances, 120. And they regularly get delayed much longer than that. So we think that to rectify that, since there have been lots of concerns and Senate oversight and complaints by a number of people about those delays, and nothing seems to happen through years of two different administrations, that we should actually change that so that if it's not reviewed within that particular time limit, then they should get default approval of the rule. We think that would actually make a big difference in terms of whether or not that happened. Really incentivize them. And then the second recommendation that we have is that there's also the highly significant rule. It's $100 million, you know that one. That gun, if you put that was set in 1978. If you adjust it so it's the equivalent ratio to what the nation's GDP was in 1978, today's terms that would be $660 million. So you'd really reduce the number of
highly significant rules that need to be put in place. And the last thing that I'll go over, and this is really key to the whole issue of information in dockets, you know what we really want to know is what the agencies are sending in and then what's coming back out and how their discussions and negotiations with OIRA have changed those. Because we can look at them, we can say it looks to us like mostly they're always weakened, but you don't always know what's going on in, and you don't always know what OIRA is saying because they engage in informal conversations before the rule is actually submitted. And that's a huge problem, and somehow we need to require copies of the pre- and post-review versions, and we want a description of when OIRA is having those conversations with the agency staff at the beginning of the rulemaking process, so they're not just sort of setting the goal lines back to here, and this is where all the conversations are happening, but then they're saying, okay, this is when we're starting with the formal submission, so we're only going to tell you how it changed from here to here, but we're not going to tell you how it changed because we had all these conversations with people back here informally. So somehow we need to do a better job of capturing all those conversations that are going on from the very beginning of the process within the agency to what comes out of OIRA at the end of the day. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Well, thank you to ELI and Vanderbilt Law School for...
Thank you, Kate. Thank you to ELI and Vanderbilt Law School for inviting me to join this very distinguished panel and for having me come to speak today. This is, you know, as I think John Cruden said in the beginning in the morning, this is without a doubt one of the most widely anticipated and respected annual conferences in our field. And so I'm very honored to be here, and thank you. And I am also very cognizant of the fact that it is 3:10 and I stand in the way of an early start to everyone's weekend. So I am going to try to go very quickly through my comments maybe cut a few things out, and hopefully that'll leave some time for questions on the tail end and for Carrie to be able to respond. And at the outset, I should say for those of you that actually haven't read Carrie's full article in the Michigan Journal of Environmental and Administrative Law, I do commend that to you to read. It's worth the read. Carrie, I think, does a really good job of providing a very nice, succinct summary of the development and goals of e-rulemaking, and then he goes on and provides 7 recommendations that I don't know that were fully fleshed out in the excerpt, but the 7 recommendations, they're on point. And I don't disagree, I think, from the standpoint of someone who also uses agency websites. Since I'm at the White House, I often use the agency websites to try to figure out what's going on. I don't disagree, and I join him in noting that there's always room for improvement, right? And that rulemaking should be a top task, is a top task. These are regulatory agencies. Regulations are their bread and butter. So I don't disagree with that. I do think that in the intervening time between when Carrie and his colleagues did the initial research and the interviews, so that was probably 2011 timeframe or so, I think there have been updates to some of the websites and many of the recommendations or suggestions that are captured in the recommendations in the article have come to pass. And that's partly because from the very first day of President Obama's administration, openness and transparency in government and using electronic media have been a priority and at the forefront of how we conduct business. And I would take just a specific example of one of the websites I'm personally most familiar with, the EPA website. It does have, at the very top of it, the fact that I'm doing this by rote memorization should tell you, but there are 4 tabs at the homepage. There are 4 tabs across the top. One of them is law and regulations. And as soon as you click on that tab, it brings up a page that has a very prominently placed a text box that says, how do I comment on regulations? And you click on that, and it takes you in one centralized location to a link to regulations.gov. It kind of walks you through. There's some directions right there that tells you how to do that. And so while it does require one additional click past Congressman Waxman or Michelle Bachman's page, it is there. And I think that there is some facility that we are increasingly seeing That is not at all to diminish, I think, as I said, the very on-point comments in the article as well as from the panelists here today. But you can get there from the web EPA's homepage. So that's at least EPA's site. Now, the Federal Communications, the FCC's site, I don't know, and I will agree. I think that's probably a little harder to navigate. And I should say that, you know, about a decade ago, I was at EPA prior to coming to CEQ, and we actually went through a very large, a very onerous effort to centralize all the functions to actually use regulations.gov. So taking every agency and finding a way to centralize all of their dockets and all of their mechanisms. And I know there are others in the room here that shared with those efforts, worked with me on those efforts. And, you know, I hate to make the analogy to steering the Titanic because the Titanic didn't end up so well. But there is that, you know, you don't change. It's hard to make sort of quick changes in this realm. But I do think, nonetheless, those efforts are underway. And there is always room for improvement, of course there is. And I think that, as I noted, for this administration, openness, transparency, public participation in rulemaking, these are cornerstone principles. The president, on his first day in office, issued a memorandum about openness and transparency in government. And from that day, we have, as an administration as a whole, right, so not just in the realm of environmental regulations, but across the board, really tried to approach governance in a way that underscores and promotes effectiveness and efficiency, and that reflects the core values we have about democracy, right? We are a government of, for, and by the people. We are a government of laws, not men, right? All of these things, these are tenets. They are the foundational principles of who we are, and I think that is reflected in the administration's commitment to continuing to push agencies to do more. And so I think a couple times folks have mentioned Executive Order 12866. And for those of you that don't know, that was an executive order that was issued by President Clinton. His predecessors had, in one form or another, since I think President Reagan, we've had since 81, some sort of centralized regulatory review function, and they're done through executive order. President Obama, in January of 2011, issued Executive Order 13563, which was designed to improve that. And I just want to read specifically from that a quote. The president directed agencies to afford the public a meaningful opportunity to comment through the Internet on any proposed regulation and to provide timely online access to the rulemaking docket on regulations.gov. So I think that there is very much the point that we hear from the academic sector, you know, Professor Farina, Kerry, others who are constantly there and providing new and innovative thinking and fresh thinking on this. We also have from the president a directive for the agencies to do this. And to me, when you have that kind of confluence, that is, in fact, when you can steer a ship. So I'm hopeful that we will get there. And our focus, as I said, is clear. We want to use electronic media to foster and encourage engagement with the public as early as possible and as often as possible. And I think that the recommendations in the full article provide a nice template for how to go about doing that. With that said, I would like to raise a slightly broader perspective for how agencies use websites, and this goes to Kerry's point about user demand, and I think what the public wants agencies to have on their websites. And I would say that Kerry's premise, I think, is based on the assumption that one of the most significant powers that a regulatory agency has is, that an executive branch agency has, is to promulgate regulations. And I think that's right. And I think to that point also, Andy's chart, which is a very striking visually, the visual effect of the chart, I think, is very striking. But I think that also reflects the fact that in 72 we started with a bunch of statutes. We have been continually implementing them over time. And so, yeah, the page number is going to go up because as we get more regulations on the book to implement those statutes, you're going to have a greater volume of page numbers. And, you know, dare I say it, part of full implementation means responding to ongoing litigation. And with every successive litigation, our regulations get a little more complex because we're now, as agencies, trying to address not just what the statutory language directed us or what our reasoned interpretation of that was, but also what courts have now told us we need to do. And so, yeah, I do think, I agree the volume is increasing, but I think that there are explanations for that beyond just agencies run amok doing crazy rulemaking. But I do think the focus on e-rulemaking for websites alone, or as the primary driver for how a website, the agency website should be designed, fails to capture the entire mission of agencies. And so what I submit to you is that there are at least three other, I'm sure there are more, but there are at least three categories that I, three key functions for agencies that I think agencies can, should, and do use their websites to accomplish. The first, and perhaps foremost to my mind, is, of course, the dissemination of information, right? It's to educate. Secondly, I think it is to be a resource to provide an open and accessible source of data to spur innovation and development. And then finally, I think agencies serve a very important function for the public, and the public increasingly relies on, and this was the point of user demand, agency websites as portals for service. And then those, all three of those are functions that the president's executive orders on these topics have articulated and fostered and encouraged, and in the parlance of executive orders, mandated or directed agencies to do. The administrative law wonks in the room will understand why I'm very careful to not use the word require there, but yeah. So the first, the public's use of agency websites, I think it really is, it's about, listen, it's about people use websites, including agency websites, to learn about the world, to learn about the issues that we're facing as a nation, the challenges we're facing, what solutions others are throwing out there, right? And I think this is an area where agencies have, in the last decade, made leaps and bounds of progress. I mean, there are definitely cluttered websites out there, but I do think that you can go to any agency website, any homepage, and pretty quickly find a way to figure out what you're looking for. It's not that. It actually, there is ease of use. And so let me use this analogy. You could be a Cub Scout trying to write a report. You could be a naturalist trying to find out more about black bear cubs in Yosemite. You could be a cub reporter trying to get your first story and make a big break looking for information on the banking industry. Or like me, you could be a Cubs fan and just want to check what the weather is on opening day. All of those things are pretty easily accessible fairly quickly from agency websites, from their homepage. And so I think, you know, someone used, I think Kerry said actually in his opening remarks on an article, websites are virtual libraries. They are. They're virtual libraries and museums. They're cornucopias of information. And information actually leads to my second point. The president has been very clear, and across the administration, along with the chief information officer in the White House and the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, there's been a real emphasis and a real drive on making sure that we are providing open source data, access to the data. Let me ask this way. How many of you this morning, speaking of opening day and weather, how many of you used a smartphone or a mobile app this morning to check weather? Right? Everybody? How many of you used GPS in the last week to get somewhere to find where you're going? So it was about a couple decades ago, somewhere in that ballpark, when the government made that data freely available, right? Since that time, people have taken that information, turned it into apps that are usable, and yes, they've made money on it, and I wish I'd had the idea or the expertise to have done it, but that's the point. That is exactly the point, is that as the government, we have at our fingertips, and this should come as no surprise, we have a vast quantity, very extensive quantity of hard data, of resources. And so the idea is to make that extensive data freely accessible, but accessible in a way that it's searchable, usable, comparable, right? I mean, we made the point about you can't compare across sites sometimes. And so the push right now is very much to do that, because we all agree that usable, accurate, good quality data actually makes our lives better in so many ways. It creates jobs, helps us respond to natural disasters. You know, it's taken us to the moon. It can take us to the moon again and beyond, right? And so I this is really an important issue for the president. In May of 2011, I'm going to hurry. Is that what you're
saying? Oh, okay. Slowly meandering up. I'm worrying about Andrea, who has a date with a judge.
Oh,
and
yes.
So I know that she needs to walk out.
Absolutely. Okay, let me wrap up.
Your remarks are wonderful, and you do not need to immediately stop.
Okay. All right, well, I will wrap it up very quickly. The president, in May of 2011, the president issued an executive order. It was Executive Order 13571, where he tasked agencies to actually solicit public input to find out ways to how better to serve the public using the Internet. And then 2 years later, last May, in May 2013, he directed agencies to use the Internet to their fullest to require the default state of new and modernized government information resources to be open and machine-readable. So just recently, last month, using that authority and under the President's Climate Action Plan, we launched the Climate Data Initiative, and it is just what it sounds like, right? People keep using the word hackathon. That sounds really gross to me, but I get that it's actually a bunch of people typing and not doing other things. the idea is that we want to make freely available climate-relevant data to stimulate innovation and entrepreneurship, and we're already seeing a lot of private partnerships that are doing that, and the end result of that is that communities have the information and tools that they need to protect themselves from harm today and to be ready for any future damages that would occur. And so then my last point that I will bring up is that the services, right? So we've talked about FOIA. Being able to submit a FOIA online is a very important thing. And there are, along those lines, I would venture to say that it's just as important to the public, and this goes to the point of user demand, just as important to be able to find an IRS form quickly and find the form you're looking for as it would be to comment on an IRS reg. Right? I don't know how many people are compelled to do that, but I'm sure there is some segment of the population that does do that. And so I think that those kinds of services are very important. And so to recap, I very much agree with the top-line points of Carrie's recommendations, and I think there is room for improvement, and we should continue to strive to do that. But I would caution and I would sort of underscore that I think agencies really have done a good job at balancing their many mission priorities and the host of functions that they provide to the public. And so with an effort to sort of make e-rulemaking more accessible, I wouldn't want to see any sort of loss, concomitant loss in those other areas. So thank you all again, and thank you for the extra few minutes.
Oh, thank you for those wonderful comments. So here's my proposal. We have 2.5 minutes left in the panel. Maybe first I could let Andrea just, if she has any quick comments before she has to leave, and then maybe we'll give Carrie about 4 minutes. We'll just go 5 minutes late, and then if you all can stay for a few minutes, that would be great, and people can come up and ask you questions. So, Andrea, is there anything you'd like to say in leaving?
I just want to say one thing on that chart I put up there. That was not designed to say EPA is grasping or being overly... I want to make it clear. EPA has been told by Congress to do hundreds of rulemakings. There is no way that any agency with the budget it has and the staff it has could possibly do all of those rulemakings. I am sympathetic to what the agency is going through, and I'm not surprised that every year the regulations are longer. So just to be clear, this is not a criticism. It's just a recognition of how environmental laws are written and have to be implemented.
Thank you, Andrea. Carrie, do you want to just take a couple minutes to wrap up with some reactions, and then we'll just let people come up and ask questions?
Sure, happy to. Thank you, all the panel members, for your comments. It's always nice when you agree with me. and that's what I really heard, by and large. Minister, you're fundamentally, we're in agreement, right, that rulemaking is a preeminent function of regulatory agencies, and we could do better. You know, that's what I'm suggesting here. I'm not suggesting the agencies redesign their websites and allocate a quarter of them to rulemaking, but just put a link there, rules open for comment, that automatically pulls up all the rules. This doesn't cost anything. To Catherine's point about limited agency budgets, shrinking agency budget, I recognize that. This is easy stuff. So easy that members of Congress, with much smaller staffs, can do the same. And now it is true, I think Minister makes a good point, right? There is a fundamental sort of qualitative difference between the role of a legislator and a role of an agency, but a much broader mission for regulatory agencies. But it's also true that members of Congress do much more than just legislation as well. Their websites are devoting a lot of space to constituent services, and all that's good, and agency services should be given a lot of space, and user demand can be used for allocating that homepage space for all those other things that agencies are doing. But put a link on there that rules open for comment that citizens can find easily. I think if we take this orientation that rulemaking is substantively a top task, we will make sure that rulemaking doesn't get pushed to the side. And I'm not saying that every agency does this, but too many do. And even after the ACUS recommendation, still, unfortunately, too many, including, I might add, EPA, which has a lot of great things to its website and has a lot of great things about ease of access to regulatory information. But it's RegDart, for example, that web page that I mentioned, it links you over to the general regulations.gov website, and then you've got to search through there to find rules that you're interested in or rules that are open for comment. Much easier, much simple to do what members of Congress are doing. Put the canned search in. Use the regulations.gov in a very cost-effective way, minimal cost, to just link over and pull up the rules that are open for comment. If we take open government seriously, it seems to me this is a no-brainer.
Carrie, thank you. Catherine or Manisha, do you have any quick closing thoughts?
To Manisha's point, there are a lot of agencies that are doing really interesting apps that are citizen-requested apps. So things like product recalls, you can take your little, put it on your phone and go through and see what products have been recalled when you go shopping, and air quality apps for people with asthma, things like that. I think if you ask most people, those kinds of things would probably be higher up on the priority list of what they want from government, and I think that's important. But you still have the translation problem. And we work with the chief information officers all the time, and we go and talk to them all the time, and they're wonderful people. And it doesn't always trickle down to the agency level. There's just tremendous variability in terms of getting that executive order all the way down to the bottom. And there are still a lot of communities. For example, with the EPA, we are still doing, in the wake of West Texas and others, we're pulling down data from the toxic release inventory and the risk management plan, the facilities that have risk management plans, and creating maps that show how close those facilities are to hospitals and schools, that the environmental justice community is using to go into public hearings and do their own commentary. Those are not things that are on any government website right now. But there's also a lot of interesting new ideas that they're trying to do with those kinds of visualizations and maps, thanks to Esri and some other firms. So I think we just have a really mixed bag right now, where lots of people are trying to do the right thing and figure out how to make use of whatever data that they have. But you're right. This is a no-brainer. This is really easy. We're talking about harder stuff here. What you want,
really. Yeah, and I guess...
Realist.
Well, and let me, I guess, in closing, just leave you with one thought, which is... keep the ideas coming, right? I mean, I think that's the point, is that, yeah, we do have limited resources, and it is hard to get all these disparate and various systems together, but, I mean, we're talking about public participation here, so if you have a great idea or if you see a need or if something's not working, let someone know. These comments do find their ways into policies, and we, again, going back 15 years, we've come a long way, and we're going to continue to keep going. So thank you again.
Well, great. And Merrick, I think, is going to close us out here, and then I hope we'll all join in thanking the panel.
Perfect. Thank you. My name is Merrick Parrott. I am the symposium editor for LPAR, and I just wanted to very quickly wrap up today. First, I wanted to thank our panelists for all the information they've shared with us. It has been incredibly insightful, and I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed learning from you all. I also wanted to thank everyone in the audience for coming today. I can't tell you how much LPAR appreciates your support and engagement on these critical issues. So thank you all again for coming, and we hope to see you next year.